everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's May 2025, and this is episode 444, which is a conversation about season 2 of Apple TV Plus's Severance. Today, I welcome two guests onto the show. It is Dr. Melissa Kane Travis, who is a fellow of Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. She is the author of Thinking God's Thoughts and the author of Science and the Mind of the Maker. I also welcome on the podcast for the first time today, Dr. Julie Miller. She has an earned PhD in philosophy and humanities from Faulkner University's Great Books Honors College. She is also the author of Critiquing Transhumanism, The Human Cost of Pursuing Techno-Utopia. Julie has served with Ratio Christi since 2011, and she is a senior fellow at the Society of Women of Letters. Melissa has written an exclusive online feature article called Persons Don't Disintegrate, Apple TV's Severance, and the Continuity of Identity Problem. In addition, Julie Miller has written an accompanying article, and you can read both of their articles for free at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Melissa, it's great to have you back on the podcast, and we have a new voice on our podcast today, and that's Dr. Julie Miller. I'm excited to talk to both of you about Severance.
Yes, thanks for having me back, Melanie. I'm really excited to have Julie in the conversation today. I think she can bring an angle to the discussion that will be unique and intriguing to the listeners.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, yes. I'm really glad to have you. So Severance has become this big kind of water cooler cultural phenomenon right now. It's very much trending. It's the series of the moment. And I don't know when it first came out, it sounded like people hadn't really seen it. And now that the new season has come out, people are discovering it, and it's become the new big hit series that everybody's been talking about. All kinds of people that I didn't know watch TV in my circles, like some friends at church, they're all really into Severance and watching it every week. But I want to ask you guys, first of all, what drew you to watching the show, and why are you so enthusiastic about it? I know for me, I'm someone, and we've covered this in the Christian Research Journal years before we had podcasting, who watched Lost. So this kind of had that Lost kind of vibe to me, or some of those kind of shows where there's a mystery to be solved or some kind of riddle to be solved or answered. And so I was immediately, when I read that it was coming, very interested in the premise.
Yeah. So shows like this one and like Lost, I was also a huge, huge Lost fan. But this episode, sorry, not this episode, but this season of Severance and all the reading that I've done pertaining to the show has introduced me to a term I had actually never heard before. And it was the puzzle box television show. And that's how they classify Lost. That's how they classify Severance and other shows where there's this mystery that's just very, very gradually unraveling. And I love that. But it's also true that science fiction's my favorite genre of both film and television. So to have science fiction combined with a puzzle box concept is really exciting to me. And I'm very fortunate that my husband has the same taste in TV and film that I do. So we have a lot of fun watching new things like this. But when Severance popped up on our radar, we actually knew nothing about it going in. We just saw the little picture pop up on our Apple TV app. And we read the synopsis. It sounded super intriguing. So we watched the season one, episode one, the very day it came out. And we were hooked immediately because you're plunged into this strangeness and mystery from the very first scene of the show. And the cinematography is really cool. The writing is outstanding. And at first we were worried that it would be one of those shows that starts out really great and you have this deep mystery. And then as time goes on, it fizzles or the pacing is terrible. But we thought it was exactly the opposite because each new episode seems to draw you deeper and deeper into the mystery. And for me, all these weird philosophical questions that it raises. And I think we ended up watching season one like 4 times through while we waited for season two to come out because it took forever. It was like 3 years after season one that season two finally came out. And then just this past week, I started all the way back at the beginning and started watching the first season again. And what's so interesting is even this time around, I'm catching different lines from different characters and different visual cues that are so subtle I hadn't noticed them before. And then it's been interesting to see how many YouTubers have started trying to pinpoint all the different little Easter eggs and kind of geek out on all the trivia associated with some of the visual clues. And that would be really fun if I had time to go down all those rabbit holes, but I don't. So it's good that I have a lot more interest in the philosophical issues that are raised by the show.
So one thing about Severance is it's, like you said, it's got so many different emphases in it. And there's kind of, they put together this dystopian science. And it was interesting, after the end of season two, I listened to a podcast with two people in neuroscience. I think one's a psychologist, but they have degrees in that. They're both doctors. And they were talking about, is it possible? But there's some of the things that they show in Severance that are things that are actually done. So it's very interesting. So let's describe the series, because some people, it's been so long, it's been 3 years. Why don't you, before we get into what is being severed, can you give an overview, a little bit, big kind of grand overview, either Julie or Melissa, what the series is about for some of our listeners who maybe they don't know what this is about and they're just tuning into this podcast?
Yeah. So since I'm a lot more obsessive about the show than Julie is, I'll just give a little overview here. So the idea behind the series is that a technology has been developed such that you can have a chip implanted in your brain. And when the chip is activated, it severs you into two separate consciousnesses so that your new conscience that results from the severed process does not retain all the memories of your original consciousness, and you can, through this technology, switch back and forth, like episodically, between these two different consciousnesses. And the advantage to someone getting the severed procedure is that they can then move forward living part of their life without the psychological pain, whether it's like grief or anxiety or fear or just traumatic memories or whatever. They can live at least part of their life without consciousness of all of this psychological yuckiness. And so that's the opening premise of the show. And then as the show moves on, you start to encounter more of these philosophical questions, like what constitutes an individual human person, and so on and so forth. And then part of the big puzzle box of the series is that you have this corporation, Lumen Technologies, that seems to have tentacles all throughout the society. And you start really expecting there to be some revelations of nefarious practices and so on and so forth. And that, as it goes on, turns out to be true. But they do a really fantastic job of just keeping you guessing from one episode to the next. Well, who's in charge and what's being manipulated here and what's actually reality over here? I just think it's quite brilliant. And so, like I said, we were hooked from episode one.
So you talked about the severing technology where you have a different consciousness, but in the same body, but that consciousness is not aware of the other consciousness. And in the series, these two different consciousnesses are called innies and outies, and the context of it is work. So your innie, who is a separate conscious alertness is only kind of awake during your work hours, and then your outie is your out of office kind of hours is what's happening there. And I mentioned that I heard a podcast with some people who work in neurology, and I would like to know this severing technology that you just talked about, that, you know, fictional chip that you put into someone's brain to help sever their consciousnesses, as it is in the series. It seems really, you know, out there, like you're talking about sci-fi, and really radical to most people. But is something like this possible, even in theory? I mean, that's some of the discussion that I heard between these folks that worked in neurology. Is something like that even possible?
I'll answer this one, Melanie. The show doesn't really reveal the exact nature of the severing technology, and I think Melissa described it very well. But there is, like you probably heard on that podcast, current technology being developed to erase negative memories, which seems to be the motivation of our characters to, and the appeal of being severed, right? To erase or to have some relief from negative or traumatic memories. Well, the first time I ever heard about such a thing was from David Pierce. Now, he's a philosopher and a transhumanist, so he's not like a neuroscientist or a cognitive scientist, but he's the co-founder of Humanity Plus, which is the big transhumanist organization. And he said this: in the future, I think all bad memories will be selectively erased. And this is on their website, Humanities Plus. The technology in the show goes far beyond just selectively erasing memories, as I think Melissa is going to get into about identity. But the current research on erasing memories is progressing. So it's an active research project, you could say. In 2017, from Columbia University, there was a paper entitled "Select Memories Can Be Erased, Leaving Others Intact." And their findings showed that they had successfully erased select memories from a snail. Okay, so we're not talking about humans yet, but that's how all good research starts, right? In a recent Times article, and this was in March of this year, the article was entitled "How Realistic Is the Severance Procedure? Brain Surgeons Have Some Thoughts." And this particular brain surgeon, Dr. Hooman Azmi, says this: "I don't believe that the memory control severance depicts is entirely out of the realm of possibility. Just not," he's very modest, so he says, "just not in the foreseeable future. We'll probably reach the day that perhaps we can deselect memories," but he thinks it's many years away. So he's got a modest view about the technology. However, this was interesting, goes back to how you think lay people are responding to this kind of technology. This was in Trends in Neuroscience. And the paper was entitled "How to Erase Memory Traces of Pain and Fear." And the conclusion of the whole paper was, there is clearly a great demand to erase the memory traces of pain and fear. Understanding how to achieve this goal is only just emerging. And that's exactly what researchers are working on. But the weird thing was, after I read this paper, I saw Adam Scott interviewed on, I think it was Jimmy Kimmel, and I couldn't find it to tell you the exact date of it or whatever. And Jimmy Kimmel asked the audience if they would want to be severed, because the whole, you know, interview was about severance. And about half the audience cheered and clapped. So I think that's very telling and kind of something maybe we can talk about, what's driving and motivating regular audience members to say they would undergo this technology if it was available. So to sum up, I mean, the technology to erase select memories isn't yet available for humans, but I would say that it's being researched.
As I've noted for the last several episodes, we'd like to hear from you. we would like to be able to hear your ideas and thoughts on the content we have at the Christian Research Journal. So if you have a suggestion for an article idea that you would like to see us cover, or you would like to write a letter to the editor, perhaps one of our articles struck you in a particular way and you would like to make a comment about it, please contact us at response@equip.org. That's response@equip.org. Now, if you haven't checked out our website, please go to equip.org, because we have thousands of articles that span our almost 50 years of publishing. And so we are a resource here for you. There's so much for you to discover. And all of our articles, even from decades ago, are still very relevant, because we are covering theological topics and Christian ethics and Christian living. And so please, we welcome you to explore our website at equip.org. And now back to my conversation with Melissa Kane Travis and Julie Miller about Severance Season 2. Well, we're kind of talking about, is this possible in real world, real life situations? And it's kind of interesting, not necessarily like this fictional severance procedure, but there's actually a split brain surgery procedure that goes back, oh my goodness, more than 60 years. And I think it was for people who had epilepsy, but also when this happened, it really did have two different parts of their brain were not communicating the way it had been before. So that's really fascinating. So I want to ask you about these real life cases. And before I do, before the break, Julie was mentioning Adam Scott on a late night TV show. That's the actor who plays the main character, Mark S., or Mark Scout. And he is somebody in the show that we follow who has been severed. But how are some of these real life cases of literal split brain surgeries, are they different than severance, or are they kind of adjacent to severance?
So I'm going to let Julie say the most about this, but I want to offer one thing that sort of bridges our previous question with this idea of the split brain procedures. So I would say that what they're portraying in Severance definitely crosses a line from scientific feasibility, even in the future. That's what I mean by scientific feasibility. Could it ever happen? To more fantastical stuff that we could say is just pure science fiction. And as I was doing some research to prepare for our podcast, I found a really interesting essay on the Scientific American website where, Melanie, they talk about the split brain procedures and how this might compare to what's going on in the show. And this particular essay came out this past January. So they released it ahead of the premiere of Season 2 of Severance. But they were exploring this idea of what it would possibly look like to use a chip to sever somebody. And the authors of the essay explained that the hippocampus of the brain is probably the most likely candidate for any physical brain structure that could actually be manipulated in this type of way. And the reason that for that is because the hippocampus is responsible for segmenting our conscious experiences into like discrete episodes that we can later recall. And then there's a spatial element that's also involved in this kind of processing that happens with the hippocampus. But simply severing the connections in the hippocampus, like sort of analogous to what we do in a real life split brain surgery, it wouldn't achieve what we actually see on the show between the innies and outies, because there are just so many other aspects of consciousness that would also have to be manipulated. And that would include things like our semantic knowledge, our memories, emotional memories of things like the rewards and the punishments that happen on the severed floor. You know, they go to that really creepy room and they're essentially psychologically tortured if they do something bad enough, or they get fun little parties like the egg party or the melon ball party or the waffle party if they do something good. So it's like this punishment rewards thing. But emotional memories of things like rewards and punishment could not be achieved with real life examples of hippocampus manipulation. And then the article's authors also pointed out that when it comes to episodic memory retrieval, which is what they're trying to prevent with the severed procedure, right? There's this whole brainwide network involved. It's not just one part of the brain that you could target. And then there's a whole extra problem involving memory, and that is that memory is very closely related to a lot of other cognitive processes like perception and language, and those kinds of things are associated with completely separate regions of the brain. And there's this scene in the first episode of season two that immediately struck me as problematic in this regard, and I just want to mention it before I turn it over to Julie to talk more about split brain. But in the first episode of season two, we're introduced to Mark's new team in macrodata refinement. And one of them is a young woman named Gwendolyn Y. And Gwendolyn approaches Mark because, spoiler alert, in season one, his innie is able to briefly experience the outside world. And so Gwendolyn's so excited to talk to Mark about his experience. And she says, what was the sky like? And what was the wind like? And I immediately had this red flag. And my question was, well, how would Gwendolyn Y have these abstract semantic concepts of things like the sky and the wind, but not also have perceptual memories of those things, such that she has to ask Mark S., well, what is the sky like and what is the wind like? That just didn't make much sense to me. So all of that to say, I think this whole splitting of consciousness and the way it's presented on the show is probably impossible, but, you know, maybe something far more modest in terms of memory manipulation could one day be achieved. I think some of the data that's recorded from the early split brain surgeries back in like the 1940s and 1950s is pretty fascinating, where you could ask patients after surgery to answer a question, and what they would answer out loud would be different than what they would write down. If they were writing down the answer to the question, their answers would conflict, which was really interesting and opens up questions about, well, which sides of our brain are responsible for what kind of processing. But anyway, I'll turn it over to Julie and let her say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the benefit of studying split brain patients is the, you know, what hemisphere is of our brains are responsible for certain things. I think that's the real information they get. But regarding, it's just like Melanie said, I mean, this was early in the 20th century that they did split brain procedures for those very severe patients with epilepsy. And actually, it's sort of the last thing they would do if they can't, if drugs or anything don't work today, they still do split brain for very severe cases of epilepsy. But so during the procedure, it's just like Melissa said, the connections between the hemispheres are severed to prevent the spread of the epileptic activity, but also communication between the hemispheres is severed. So what they had the traditional view up until recently was that the split brain patient had two seats of consciousness. But so that the person would experience split consciousness. Okay, this was the findings very early, but like recently, I mean, fairly recently, they still study split brain patients, by the way. So it's not all said and done. A 2017 study from the University of Amsterdam. It's called the paper was "Split Brain Does Not Lead to Split Consciousness," Their findings concluded that split brain patients do not have two independent conscious perceivers in one brain. Although the two hemispheres are completely insulated from each other and separated, the patient experiences the world as one conscious agent. So in other words, those findings actually provide evidence that consciousness, being immaterial, can't be split. Like your brain is material, it can be split. But consciousness, identity, the self, first-person consciousness, they're not identical to your brain. You have a brain. You are not your brain, but you have a brain. So I think it will continue to have these kinds of findings. And I agree with Melissa that the two consciousness theory is not going to it's not going to be achieved.
So I want to talk about some of the philosophy that is hinted at in the series. I think we were talking off air before we started that they've introduced a bunch of stuff that I don't know if they have thought through some of the philosophical questions that they're asking beyond the nature of people at work or corporations and things like that, which is the setting of this kind of sci-fi post, kind of like a just one of these made up worlds within our real world kind of place. But one of those big overarching philosophical questions that really is in both of the seasons of the show is whether this severance procedure makes someone into two different people. And so how do you think they've handled this question? Because definitely, like you said, there was a point at the end of season one that's the big, kind of cliffhanger where they're the person that's only conscious at work, suddenly is in a situation where their outie lives and they see something they've never seen before. So how do you think that they have handled this, even if it couldn't technically, when we talked about the science, could it technically be done right now? Not really, but what about the philosophical questions behind it?
Well, as for me, I've been a bit frustrated, really, not just because they seem to be ignoring some of the deeper philosophical questions. Maybe ignoring is not the right word, but not, they don't seem to be intentionally trying to interact with the philosophy involved. But I've been a bit frustrated in another way because there seems to be a lack of consistency in the way they're treating some of these deeper questions. I don't know, again, if this is intentional on the part of the writers. I'm guessing it could be. Maybe this is part of their strategy for generating discussion and debate with their fans. If that's their intent, then that's pretty genius and it has totally worked. But very early on in season one, just to give you an example of where I think there's some inconsistency in the treatment of the questions, there's this scene where Helena, who is an outie, says to her innie, Heli R, I am a person and you are not. Okay, so we seem to have this very succinct statement about what the show is claiming about what an outie is and what an innie is not. And then we have on several different occasions, Mark, our main protagonist, as his outie, Mark Scout, he makes these various comments about his innie being him rather than being a separate person who's trapped on the severed floor over at Lumen. And then there's a scene that I thought was actually pretty powerful. And in some ways, it will turn out to be pivotal, I think, when we get to season three, where they're having this bereavement service for Irving B. Okay, so Irving B, the innie, is no longer because he's been terminated from Lumen. So they have this bereavement service because when someone never comes back, it really is for the innie community as if this person has died, right? They're never going to be in a situation where they will encounter Irving again. So they have this bereavement service and Mark is impatient. Like he just wants it to be over so he can get back to work. And there ensues this whole discussion about, don't you care that your friend has died? And Mark says, he's not dead. He's just not here. So clearly Mark is still operating on this idea that no, we are not two separate people. We are the same person. We just have, you know, two different conscious lives going on thanks to the severance procedure. So we have this philosophical discussion of like the necessary and sufficient criteria for personal identity, and then how we account for the persistence of someone's personal identity over time. And this is a conversation that philosophers have been having for centuries and centuries. I'm currently working on an article for Christian Research Journal on this topic, and I'm going to unpack some of the different philosophical accounts that relate to these concepts that are explored in Severance, even if they're not explored very well in the show. And one example would be the issue of the persistence of identity over time. Now, philosophers call this diachronic identity, which is just a fancy way of saying your continuation of your identity over time. So in Severance, in the case of the outies and the innies, if we say that we have two separate people who are merely taking turns being conscious in the same body, then we ask questions like, well, then where does the outie go when the innie person is active, or vice versa? So there was this 17th and early 18th century philosopher named Gottfried Leibniz, and he argued that you cannot have two distinct entities in the exact same spatial location at the exact same time. But you see where this is a problem for the Severance plot, because they're trying to say that the innie and outies both still continue to exist. They just exist in alternating episodes. But that's problematic, because if you like have someone go down to the severed floor and you want to say, okay, now the innie exists, the outie's not existing right now, you can't have the outie simply come back into existence at a later time. What you would essentially have on their account is just a series of copies, one after another, of each of these, the innie and the outie. You would never have one outie who exists over time and one innie who exists over time, because you lack the grounding for their personal identity. The physical brain is not sufficient to be the kind of grounding that you would actually have to have. And here's a little shout out back to our show Lost. If any of our listeners watch that show, you'll remember one of the prominent characters, the bald guy in the show. His character's name was John Locke. Well, John Locke was one of the famous philosophers that talked about this problem of the continuity of personhood. And he actually believed that psychological continuity is a main factor. And what he meant by that was that our recollection of past experiences is how we have a sense of our own continuity. But he went even further than that. He's like, it's not just that having recollection of past experiences gives us a sense of self that persists through time. He said that our personal identity actually consists in episodic memory. So that's really interesting. Think about the implication of that. You could go down all sorts of rabbit trails. So think about amnesia patients who permanently lose their long-term memory storage. Like, what would we say? Are they just a different person now? Or are they the same person who just has problems with their memory? And we could ask the same question about a dementia patient, for example. So I think for those sorts of counterexamples are reasons to believe that John Locke was way, way, way off when he said that your personal identity actually consists in your episodic memory. But if you think about the innies in Severance, when they wake up on the severed floor for the very first time, okay, they wake up on this table in the conference room, they have no psychological continuity of any kind in this moment, not that they're consciously aware of. So they're not really a tabula rasa or a blank slate, as we call it, but they lack all of their experiential memory. So John Locke, the philosopher, suggested a situation in which you could have what he called the waking, sleeping Socrates scenario. And the basic idea of this is that you could theoretically have two separate consciousnesses, but just one body. Okay, so in principle, you could have one physical human entity, but two separate consciousnesses that take turns. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. That sounds a whole lot like what they're doing in Severance. You have waking Socrates that has one set of experiences and memories and actions. And then you have sleeping Socrates who is oblivious to waking Socrates and so on and so forth. So waking Socrates could do something morally reprehensible and sleeping Socrates would not be liable for whatever words, thoughts, or actions that were carried out. And so again, the outies and the innies in Severance are sort of similar to this kind of situation. But then the show sort of throws you for a loop because like, okay, they're doing the whole John Locke thing with waking sleeping Socrates. But then you find out that there is this reintegration procedure, which, well, with one of the first characters that we encounter who's had this done, it turns out to not have been a great thing for him. But then we have Mark in season two deciding to undertake the reintegration procedure. And we see he's getting like memory crossover. The innie is having flashes. Mark is an outie is having flashes of things that were previously only accessed by their other consciousness. And then one really interesting thing that they've thrown into the show before Irving is fired from Severance, they have Irving's outie experiencing, I guess you could say, subconscious memory, and it's manifesting in these paintings that he obsessively creates. And they're all of this same dark hallway that's on the severed floor of Lumen. So there's really no way the outie could have memory of that, but somehow those memories are working their way into the outie's subconscious. And so I have the sense that what the show Severance is trying to portray is not that the Severance procedure really gives you two separate persons. It's not multiplying a person by having them undergo the Severance procedure. I think a better way to describe what they're trying to portray is the fragmentation of one person. So you get a fragmented consciousness situation, not bringing into existence a brand new person.
Because these various different consciousnesses exist in one body. It's not like you have separate bodies or they didn't clone somebody else to be a different person, that they put a consciousness that looks the same, like two different people. It's interesting, at different times in the show, there's interaction between the innies and the outies. And I think that happens more in season two. It depends on the character. Sometimes the characters, there seems to be an alliance between both of those consciousnesses. And then sometimes there's more of a struggle between both of those, especially as it's seen in the very last couple of episodes. So do you think this is intentional on part of the show's writers? I kind of side with you, Melissa, in that I feel like that they're asking some philosophical and spiritual questions that they don't realize that they're asking and posing some of these different scenarios. So, I want to know if you think it's intentional. And also, what do you think is like a big, takeaway that we should think about in terms of, you were just talking about identity, in terms of what identity is in the context of the show, because they're not housed. They're different fragments, I guess, in the same person. They're not housed in different bodies.
Right. So I'm I'm not entirely sure what the writers are trying to do in this regard. It could be that they're just exploring, right? It's just like this experimental show in which they just explore all the different issues that would arise as a result of this fictional severance procedure. And maybe, as I said earlier, ambiguity is part of their storytelling technique. They want people to be obsessing over all the different theories like people are doing. You only have to go to YouTube and type in severance to see all the theory videos. But there are some very clear conflicts that are arising between the interests of the outies and the interests of the innies. There's more language and action that strongly implies we're dealing with two separate teams. I guess you could say two separate teams of people. And you really start getting the team vibe at the end of season one when they do the override contingency thing. You know, they're all working together to figure out what the heck's going on between the severed world and the outside world. And I don't know if the writers want us to have like a team, you know, a preference for the outies or a preference for the innies or one of the outies or so on and so forth. Or if they just want us to go back and forth in our own minds about who we'd want to win, so to speak. And I'm not really sure what a big takeaway would be concerning the personal identity problem, or even if the writers intend for there to be a clear answer, or if they've even thought about whether we should be asking a question about personal identity problems in the real world. I don't know. So I think a lot of this just really remains to be seen.
So there's some interesting scenes, but there's some interesting scenes between some of the characters that you've mentioned in so far, but maybe some of our listeners might not know. So I'll just go over some of who they are, but I'd like to ask you a question about some of the beloved characters, and that is Bert and Irving. So Bert and Irving are two severed individuals, and you've mentioned retirement for one of them, but in the office at Lumen, they start developing a romantic relationship. And then on the outside, Bert is in real life married to another man named Fields. And so we have an interesting dialogue situation when Irving goes over and visits Bert and Fields in the outside world. And it's a dinner conversation that they're having, and they talk about heaven and hell. So that raises, you know, philosophical and theological, spiritual issues. And I'd like to get your thoughts on some of that, because that's a little bit more direct. Sometimes there's a little bit more direct conversations about some of these issues than others. It's just kind of suggested, but that was something that they were directly talking about.
Yeah, it sort of came out of nowhere. I was shocked and delighted that they chose to tackle these kinds of issues in the context of the show. We could do a whole series of podcasts just on that one scene. I've gone back and watched it several times. I think it's brilliantly acted. I think the dialogue is so well done. So as you said, we have this same-sex couple, Bert and Fields, Bert's outie, and then Fields, the man that he's married to, and they attend a Lutheran church. And they've been taught in their church that innies and outies actually have separate souls. Okay, so that's interesting. But then they have this very strange theology. It's this performance or merit-based idea of salvation. So you do enough good things and you avoid enough evil things and you get into heaven. But if your bad behavior outweighs your good behavior, then you go to hell. And so Bert, who had met Irving and fallen in love with Irving as an innie, Bert explains that in his younger years, he uses the word scoundrel. He's like, I was a scoundrel. And so he and Fields, after learning through their church that innies have their very own souls, they decided, well, if Bert gets severed, then that would be an opportunity for a part of Bert. And that's how they put it. I think that's a very telling phrase there. So when they say a part of Bert, they're talking about Bert as he exists as an any, with like a clean slate soul, so to speak, who has another chance to get life right and earn his way into heaven. So they're like, okay, well, part of Bert would then be able to make it into heaven, and he can be with Fields through all eternity. So clearly they have this idea of two separate souls, merit-based salvation, but it's really unclear whether they see this two souls concept as synonymous with two persons. It sounds like they see it as a fragmentation concept, like I mentioned earlier, where you have the fragments of one person have two separate souls. But that would be really weird. Like, it's almost like giving human scientists the ability to create new souls just by putting a chip in someone's brain. Like, put in a chip, activate the chip, and voila, you've got a second soul, but still at just one person. So you don't get a whole new person. But from a Christian philosophy perspective, I would argue that the soul is the seat of one's personal identity and not the other way around. So the soul's the grounding of the self. And in a way, Bert and Fields have turned this upside down in their thinking, at least, which is super strange. And then there's this whole problem of any Bert being in love with any Irving and being oblivious to the existence of Fields. And any Bert doesn't even know who Fields is. So wouldn't that completely defeat the purpose of their whole artificial salvation project? That's my question. So that's just a few of the kind of conundrums that are involved with this whole scene. But again, like I said, we could do a whole series of podcasts just on that dinner table conversation. It's so great.
And just for our listeners, there are tons of podcasts on Severance, whether they're on YouTube or on just regular podcasts. Feeds that are dissecting every part of each episode from both of the seasons, but specifically season two. I want to talk a little bit more with you all about suffering and human suffering, because one of the things you mentioned earlier in the podcast is Lumen Industries, which has been around, the fictional company, for a very long time, I think since the 1800s. They have been around, and their mission, vision, and values is kind of to get rid of human suffering. And the severance process will help people do that. And that's kind of how they market it, I guess, to people who could get severed. And so part of it is to relieve suffering, or to not, if you are suffering, to remove yourself from that pain. And I heard in one of the podcasts, they were talking about Buddhism. Someone asked them if this was like Buddhism. And they said, yeah, maybe in a way like that, to relieve yourself of this suffering, to no longer experience it. So there are three of the characters, and we've alluded to two of them before, Mark S. and Irving. And then also there's another guy that's on their team at work, and his name is Dylan. And all three of them want to get rid of this emotional suffering in the real world. Mark's wife has died in real life, so he's trying to get rid of the grief. And so if they experience, you know, emotional suffering on the severed floor, does severing solve their problem of suffering? And actually, in season two, they do experience some emotional things as they go. Like, they're outside in as a team together. They go outside on this, like, I don't know what it is, a camping trip. And there's some things that they experience there. Or do you think that they're just replacing the suffering in the real world with a different kind of suffering that they're experiencing, whether it's not meeting some arbitrary goals that their team's supposed to have, or they're confused about what they do? It's kind of still a suffering, even if it's out of boredom. So what about that? If they're trying to replace not having to suffer from the outside world, how can they be completely, you know, cut off from any kind of suffering in this new consciousness they're in?
Yeah, I'll respond to that, Melanie. I don't think they're getting rid of suffering completely, obviously. I mean, they do infer that the motivation for being severed, for most of the people, even maybe not for Helly or Helena, but, and we don't know exactly why Irving submitted to be severed. I don't think Melissa may know more about him, but they are promised that while at work, their innies are blocked from remembering their specific past emotional suffering, you know, which was what drove them to be severed in the first place. So we're all good. That's great. They're not remembering any of those terrible traumatic memories and grief and so forth. But they're just like you said, I mean, they do have suffering while at Lumen on the severed floor. I mean, and I think as it goes on, and Melissa hinted that it may be getting darker as we go through, you know, season three. It could be that their suffering within Lumen is worse than what they were trying to get up and get out of, you know, in reality. For now, it seems like maybe the suffering is new and different, but not quite as bad as what they were severed for. But especially Gemma, I think Mark's Audi's wife, Gemma, who is perpetually an innie and being experimented on, I think probably she would say her suffering within Lumen outweighed her suffering when she was a normal person in reality. But, you know, as a viewer, just my initial response and takeaway is that merely severing from reality by erasing certain memories isn't really the path to happiness, at least for in this show. I mean, it just definitely leaves you thinking about whether they're better off.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Julie. One of the things that really stands out from the beginning of the show for me is how very dehumanized the innies actually are. So they have this sterile, artificial environment. They're treated from the beginning, you see that they're treated a lot like laboratory rats, even down to this maze of hallways that they have to mentally map by trial and error, and then, you know, kind of write down directions for themselves so that they can retrace their steps to different places. And then they're rewarded with these trivial little treats for performing as they're told to perform at work. So I would totally agree that in this attempt to escape from suffering, the Audis are placing what I think of as anesthetized versions, or again, fragments of themselves, into this scenario that even at its very best is dehumanizing and really just amounts to, I think you used the word perpetual, Julie, this perpetual type of suffering. And as a side note here, there was this one statement made by Mr. Milchick in the second episode of season two that I thought was absolutely fascinating. He's talking to Mark Scout, the Audi Mark, about his innie Mark S. And he says to him, "The solace you have given him down there will make its way to you. It just takes time."
And also for our listener, Mr. Melchek is one of the supervisors, and he's unsevered. He's an unsevered supervisor of the severed floor.
Right. He's one of my top three favorite characters. I think he's just the best character in the show. But anyway, I suppose the idea when Milchick says this is that the absence of conscious grief for these 8 hours a day that Mark S. is at work is somehow impacting the physical brain in a positive way. And that over time, Mark, the Audi, Mark Scout, will benefit from the positive impact to the physical brain. That's what I'm piecing together. I'm curious if you guys think I'm on the right track with that.
I think that is what he means. But I question it heavily because if any of you have gone through grief, as I would say most everyone has, a loss, Mark, let's just take Mark because that's the one we can relate to. Mark Severing would seem to just prolong his grieving process for Gemma, because every day at 5 p.m., he's like plunged into reality again, the reality he has wanted to escape from. So he's got to deal with it every day, starting at 5 o'clock, all the way until he goes to Lumen again. And I don't think he deals with it. I think there's nothing that shows that he's working through his grieving process in reality, right?
Right.
So
it is interesting because, you know, they're agreeing to be severed, all of the employees. We're not including another person on their team, Helly or Helena, because we're not really sure of her motivations, because she's actually a relative of the people, the actual corporation, Lumen, the people who run Lumen. But they want to be free from negative emotions. And I'm not really sure why Dylan is being severed. We don't have that much background on him, because in real life, he has this robust life. He's got little children and he's married. So we're not really sure why he did that. But they're given this promise that they're not going to suffer, like you said, from these various different kinds of grief or trauma or whatever. But it's interesting, at the very last part of season two, there's death, there's animal death, there's all kinds of suffering on the severed floor. So that is really interesting how they're going to kind of, I guess, thread that needle in terms of, it's supposed to be suffering free, and yet there were deaths. Or one was, you find out that there has been multiple animal deaths in the past. So you just realize it's not like there's no suffering of anything that's happening there. But what about negative emotions? Like you were saying, Julie, you know, it's like he comes back every day from work and then he's faced again with the loss of his wife, and he's drinking heavily and those kinds of things. But is there any kind of role that negative emotions could play in terms of our own being human, in terms of human flourishing and well-being? I mean, should we want to completely never have any kind of interaction with suffering or trauma or grief of any kind? And what do you think would happen to us in our humanity if we did decide to be severed and it really worked, like you were completely removed from all suffering?
Yeah. And of course, this is what we talked about earlier, that they're actually working on. They are working on calling up traumatic memories, things like this, that they can erase and abolish from our, you know, memory. And, you know, I mean, who wouldn't be sort of at least a little bit motivated if you had PTSD, if you had an extremely traumatic experience that you couldn't, you know, get over? So why not? What would persuade you not to be severed? In other words, to get rid of your negative emotions? Well, just the facts are that negative emotions, and like grief, sadness, anger, depression, jealousy, guilt, shame, I think people experience that, anxiety, fear, they're actually valuable for our well-being. Two philosophers, Julian Diana and Fabrice Tironi, they have a paper that's called Feel Bad, Live Well. And in it, they argue that negative emotions are fundamentally valuable for human flourishing. And this is not too hard to understand or reason with, but negative emotions provide information to us about the world and ourselves. Like an example would be, if we had moral anger about something, it can draw our attention to actively pursue genuine justice, right, for someone. And it helps us, drives how we should respond and act. If I experience guilt, I'm provided with a clue or a signal that I've done something wrong. So we can't say that they're not valuable and they don't do anything for us. Negative emotions can initiate self-reflection about our character and then motivate me to develop virtue. So I think it's very dangerous to want to, even though I would so sympathize with someone, a veteran who had PTSD and wanted to erase any of those memories. But the fact is that we're more than just matter. So we're more than physics and chemistry. And I think our memories are not just a physical thing that can be zapped. So I think there are other ways to deal with negative emotions that are interrupting your life or you think need to be erased. I don't think this is the answer. And I think that these two philosophers are onto something about trying to teach us that negative emotions actually are valuable for our character.
Yeah, I agree with that, Julie. I'd only add that the experience of psychological suffering, I'd say, is in some ways essential to the human experience in a fallen world. So a while back, Julie and I had an interesting conversation about the problem with using technology to just eliminate negative emotions. So imagine that scenario. Imagine that you are unable to experience grief when someone you dearly love passes away. Okay, think about that scenario. Maybe the person you love most in the world passes away very suddenly, but because of some technology that you're using, you're not able to experience even an inkling of grief for this loss. So this artificial inability to grieve, I would argue, is worse than the experience of the grief when we're talking about our essential humanity. I'm reminded of the novel Brave New World, where everyone's on this medication called Soma, S-O-M-A. It's this little pink pill. And everyone takes this medication all the time because it makes them just blissfully happy no matter what happens in their lives. And we read about that, and that's very much fitting with a dystopian world, right? Because intuitively, we know that's not the right solution to psychological suffering. In other words, dehumanizing ourselves is not the answer. And I think deep down, we know this. Like, as averse as we might be to the suffering, the psychological suffering element of being a human in a fallen world, dehumanization is not the solution.
And I also think that you guys touched on, you know, when we go through suffering or just hard circumstances, that's when the human spirit, a lot of times, whether people are believers or unbelievers, becomes very resilient. And through that suffering, there's ways in which we encourage other people or, you know, any number of people who have become handicapped. And like maybe they become a paraplegic or just these different things. I'm sure they wish they weren't, but through their suffering, they've been able to help other people too. So it's kind of interesting to even think of the premise of no suffering, because it seems also by the reverse that if somebody lives a life of ease and they've never had suffering of any kind and they just have everything that they need, they're less empathetic. They're less...
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean? They just take everything for granted. And also, I read somewhere sometime about like a lot of companies that have become really successful years ago, less now, is like someone came from a really hardship to overcome that hardship to make this particular device or found a company or do these things. And those kinds of things, those big kind of things, are not really born out of just a life of ease where you have everything that you need and no suffering. So another thing I want to ask you too about, and Melissa mentioned you love science fiction shows. So I would like to talk to you about just technology and ethics. We were talking about this before that before the show. I was just thinking about how less people are wanting to study liberal arts or STEM is really emphasized. But can we really divorce technological advances from ethics and philosophy? So why do you think that these science fiction shows, besides being so fun to watch, why are they valuable? I think it's probably true that, you know, academic papers are probably not enough for the average person to really grasp some of these things. So what's good about some of these kinds of shows?
I'll try this first. It's interesting because I wonder if all the people who are so excited about Severance read an academic paper on this kind of technology and the consequences or whatever, they wouldn't be that excited about reading about that, right? So TV shows, films, sci-fi, this sci-fi literature that imagine the consequences of technology, they're actually very essential for helping us grasp the meaning of things like a technology that is emerging. It's not here yet. So it's imagining what it could be. And C.S. Lewis calls this dipping abstract arguments in a story. So he thought we had to have logical arguments because there's bad arguments. He said, we have to have good arguments because there's bad arguments out there. But what we really need is for abstract arguments to be dipped in stories so they come back to us very powerful and clearly about the consequences. So I like Walker Percy too, because he writes something in his essay, Notes for a Novel About the End of the World. And he said that sci-fi novelists are like prophets. They're canaries in a coal mine. When a canary detects harmful conditions and cries out and then collapses, it's time for the miners to take notice of what's going on. So the writer of Severance to me is like a prophet or a canary, because he is imagining, you know, however well he does it, what the harmful consequences are of submitting to like a severing technology. Now, it's our responsibility to thoughtfully count the human cost, but the writers, and especially the writer of Severance, is giving us this imaginative story so that we can grasp the meaning of it. So I think it's essential.
Yeah, I agree with Julie. I would only add, this is just a question, not a comment. I'm curious to find out really where the show goes from here in this regard. If they're going to try to say, well, it's because of the corruption at the high corporate levels that the science is misused, not that there's an intrinsic danger or anything intrinsically wrong with the science and the technology itself. So that's just my outstanding question mark about what the show's writers are going to do from here.
Yeah. Of course, the misuse of technology, you know, imagining that a technology could be misused, then would give you pause to whether we should develop it, right? So even then, yeah, I think it's valuable.
Well, and I also think that technology is developing faster than we can keep up with, especially with AI. And I don't know if people have thought through all the ramifications, whether, you know, we can argue it will never philosophically become sentient or something like that. But even if it could, we're not really thinking through all the applications of all these different kind of technologies. And that's something that the average person interacts with every day. I mean, if everyone has a smartphone, they interact with AI either through Google or Siri, or maybe you have Alexa in your home. So everyone is interacting with it, even at the most basic. If you're not asking it questions, everyone uses it for maps or knows someone who uses it for maps or is driving someone who's using AI for maps. So we're all interacting with these technologies, but really, have we thoughtfully thought about what are the ethics behind some of these things? And so how should, you know, some of these different technologies might be super far out to us now, like Severance. But honestly, the iPhone was invented in 2007. I don't think any of us in 2007 would have thought we're not going to use Thomas Guide Brothers Maps anymore. We're not, you know, we're going to have phones. Everyone's going to have a phone in their pocket. Even if they live in more of a remote village in Africa, everyone's going to have these things. I don't think we really realize how fast technology is moving. So how can the Christian or the Christian apologist think through some of the ethics behind some of all of this that's just coming up? Even if it is, quote unquote, not possible today. I don't know if you have seen some of those older movies. I don't know if it's even 2001 A Space Odyssey, or the one I was thinking of as, what's the one that was based on a novel? It was based on a Philip Dick novel, and then Tom Cruise was in that. Do you remember which one that was? Where they had those different like AI things in the water, or these. But
is it Clockwork Orange? Is it Clockwork Orange? No.
No, it was a different one that Tom Cruise was in it. But anyway, part of it, like cars would drive up sides of Rhodes and stuff. I mean,
oh wait, was that Minority Report?
Oh yeah, okay.
You guys remember in Minority Report, he was walking by billboards that were starting to give him ads specifically for him. Now, this was based on a, you know, short story that's written in the 1960s, and you're just like, that is nuts. That's never going to happen. Well, that's what we're dealing with now. And that movie was in the 1990s. So that's why I'm asking you this question, because we think, okay, severance is too far out there, but just think how far, like, this stuff that Philip Dick thought was kind of wild, and then we saw this sci-fi movie in the 90s, and now it's here. Like, we get onto our computer, and everything is, depending on where we went, there goes the billboard, or there goes the ad that is specifically towards us. It's no longer sci-fi.
You're so right. We just read a short story at the Society for Women of Letters, The Machine Stops, and it was written in 1909. Melanie, you would love it, and it is very relevant. So, yeah.
So how do we prepare ourselves to think about all these, you know, we see this, we think, oh, that's never going to happen, and yet here it is at our door. As Christians, how do we process all of this?
Yeah. Well, I'll start, and then Melissa can add something too. First of all, it's true that I think our culture equates technology with progress. So that's kind of a given. And so it also seems like tech innovators, tech research, especially AI researchers, seem to be unstoppable. And haven't you ever heard futuristic or even just regular people say, well, if we can do something, we should do it. If we can do it technologically, well, we should. You know, if we can erase memories, we should be able to do that. And I immediately think of, there's a meme that says, the science department says they can clone a T-Rex, and the humanities department will tell you why that's a bad idea, you know. And so that's our responsibility, is to critique emerging technologies as best we can. I have a theory about why technology goes unchecked like this and not ethically critiqued and everything. I think it's because most people aren't in the technology field, right? I'm not a brain neurosurgeon. I'm not a cognitive science. I'm not an AI researcher. But as Melissa and I have talked, it's okay not to understand everything about a new technology, because they're operating on a philosophy of, in this case, severance narrative is operating on a philosophy of human persons, and it's a materialist philosophy. And so it makes that everything technology can solve, as long as it's physics and chemistry or material or DNA or neurons firing in your brain. But if human persons are more than physics and chemistry, and if happiness and well-being are more than genetically controlled, just biochemistry and neurons firing in your brain, then it's easy for us to critique and say, well, a brain chip that erases your bad memories can't be a solution for that kind of happiness that we're yearning for. And it can lead to dangerous and extreme absurdities. So I guess what I'm saying is, we have to be able to critique the philosophy that underlies the technology. Most of the time it's materialism, especially if they're talking about applying technology to human persons. If they think you're just physics and chemistry, then they are sure that their technology will do whatever the physical thing they want to do. But if we're not just physics and chemistry, then it is liable to be a train wreck. So,
yeah, I'm reminded of C.S. Lewis's words about sometimes the most progress you can make is to turn back around and go back the way you came and choose a different path, right? Because he calls it the great myth, right? Capital G, capital M, the great myth, which is this myth that progress is always good, right? We're always getting better. And so this would also apply to technology. And by the way, C.S. Lewis explored this in his third book of his Ransom trilogy, which is entitled That Hideous Strength, where just because you can do it does not mean you should. And the more I've thought about this, the more I've wondered if this is really one of the one of the elements of human hubris, right? It's like, okay, we have the power to do this thing, to achieve this technological quote unquote advancement. And so we need to do it so that we can prove that we can. It's like it's one more block on the whole Jenga tower of the edifice of human achievement is the way I think about it. So like there's this hubris, this pride driving us to just show that we can do it, you know, an achievement in the realm of technology. And I think that's a lot of what drives people to just full steam ahead with completely disregard for the ethical ramifications or any of the very bad things that could result from the misuse of some such technology.
In passing, Julie mentioned like bringing back a T-Rex, but actually, I don't know if our listeners know, there is a biotechnology firm in the United States called Colossal, and they've raised over $400 million to do just that. They're going try to bring back the dodo bird and some various different extinct animals that they want to do. So
there are I was going to mention that because it's called de-extinction.
Yes, de-extinction.
Yep. They've done it with supposedly. I mean, you would have to. There's a nuanced thing about it, but is it the dire wolves? They've done that.
Yes, the dire wolves.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so they want to bring back previously lost species through cloning, back breeding, and genome editing. So, as crazy as that sounds, I mean that meme I said is an old meme, you know, but it's coming to pass. So it's crazy.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Well, I want to wrap this discussion up by asking you just about how the Christian apologist can use some of these science fiction stories that we're hearing in Severance and use them as a springboard to talk about the truth of Christianity. I mean, definitely it's a very grim show in some ways. The town that they live in, the Audis live in, as you see some of the Audi lives, it seems very depressing. They don't have much community. They're just kind of almost sleepwalking through their lives. Things seem quite bleak there. And so how can we use this show, which everyone loves and is just kind of obsessing over and rewatching and listening to podcasts about, as a tool for the Christian apologist?
So I'm going to make a very premature prediction about the show. This is what I'm hoping will eventually happen. So Melanie, I love your use of the word bleak, because that's the word that comes to my mind every time I watch the show. There's a bleakness in the real world, but there's a comparable, just different kind of bleakness on the severed floor of Lumen. And what I'm hoping is that when the show comes full circle, that we will be able to look at the story arc from the perspective of cultural apologetics, or imaginative apologetics more specifically, and say, here we have a fantastic example of what the dichotomy looks like between disenchantment, which is a big buzzword in the cultural apologetics world these days, disenchantment and re-enchantment. So that's sort of a side thing that I'm hoping for. We'll see how it all pans out in the end. But in general, I would say that science fiction as a genre is, I would argue, the most useful of them all, whether it's literature, film, or television, when it comes to usefulness in imaginative apologetics. So for listeners that may not know this, science fiction is historically considered a subgenre of fantasy. And if you think about it, it makes total sense. But particularly in our technology-driven society, where science is considered by many to be the epitome of human knowledge and achievement, science fiction can actually be tremendously helpful in sparking the kinds of conversations that turn out to be very productive in an apologetic sense. Part of being human, I would argue, is this powerful intuition that there are things that are more important than scientific progress, and even more important than utilitarian attempts to improve the human condition one way or the other. Clearly, as I said earlier, there are dehumanizing aspects of some technologies that are actually designed to alleviate physical suffering. So when we see these kinds of ideas playing out in the form of stories, especially stories with characters that we strongly resonate with in one way or another, what happens is we naturally become fascinated with the human dimension that's part of the broader story that includes the theoretical science. And that gets us really thinking more philosophically about things like what is a human person and what is permissible. And this is the point of interface that we as Christians can really capitalize on when we have conversations with non-believers about a show like Severance. So it gives us this really fun common ground on which to meet a fellow human being and encourage them to start thinking more deeply about the implications of stories like what we find in Severance.
Yeah, I agree with everything Melissa said. I also think just the themes that we discussed today are themes that just the average person can think through since they've got the structure of the show in their mind and having watched it and sort of envisioned what the technology does. They can more easily imagine the dehumanizing consequences. And one thing we mentioned before was the misuse of technology, because I think scientists and researchers don't necessarily think about bad actors or bad people using the technology bad. And I think that's because, and I don't know if any of the writers are Christians or not, but they don't have any solution for the sinful human condition, right? And so it crops up in sci-fi a lot. The misuse of technology is usually from bad actors, right? Not that the technology can't be inherently bad too, but that you add that you have a lumen, you know, controllers involved, and you can really see that what we really need is a solution for our sin, which we have in Christianity, in Christ. But also, just like Melissa said, take stock of how do you handle negative emotions and grief and things like that, and bad memories? You know, do you want to just take a pill or get rid of them through technology? So these are really good questions for people to ask themselves and answer.
Well, this has been a fun conversation today about all these different issues as it relates to Severance. But finally, on a much lighter, fun note, I have questions for each of you. Well, Julie is new to this podcast, so I have to ask her our normal questions for new guests. Well, first of all, Julie, would you say you're an early bird or a night owl?
Early bird.
And what is your favorite meal?
I have no idea. I don't have I'm so sick of making dinners and food at my house.
You have no favorite meal. Well, for Melissa, I have, it's almost summer, Melissa. So would you rather go swimming at the beach or at a lake?
Oh, at the beach. Because there's fish. There's lots of colorful fish.
Well, thanks, Melissa and Julie, for being a guest today on the Postmodern Realities Podcast.
Thanks, Melanie.
Thank you.
This was so much fun.
You've been listening to episode 444 of the Christian Research Journal's Postmodern Realities Podcast. Today's guests were Dr. Melissa Kane Travis and Dr. Julie Miller. We've been talking about season 2 of Apple TV Plus's Severance. Melissa has written our main article on this television series. It's called Persons Don't Disintegrate, Apple TV's Severance and the Continuity Identity Problem. In addition, we have an article that goes along with it by Dr. Julie Miller. You can read both of those articles for free without any paywall at equip.org.
That's EQUIP.org.
You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.